to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got the one and only Bobby Osinski. Bobby, welcome.
Hi, Mike.
And right next to him, we've got, oh my gosh, we've got another Bobby. Bobby Somerville.
Hey, Mike.
Apparently, Bobby swallowed a frog. Across the table, we've got the one and only Brandon Birdsong.
What's up, Mike?
And next to Brandon, we've got the Iron Man of the Audio Nowcast. That's still my favorite nickname.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, I've never missed a show. This is 97, Arbiter.
Hello there, Mike. Is it really 97?
97.
Yikes.
Gang, this is 97.
Wow.
So in honor of 97, we decided to switch studios. So I want everybody to bear with us. If you notice things are a little different on the show, it's because we are in a brand new room to do the podcast. So, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Sounds good so far.
How bad could it get? I mean, quite frankly, I ask you. Microphones were on.
So we're just going to dig right into it. A couple things we're going to talk about. The first thing we're going to talk about is, guys, I want to talk about latency. And it's probably perhaps the most unsexy thing you could talk about in music. It's not as cool as the mic pre's. It's not as cool as EQs or compression. But latency is probably one of the most misunderstood things in digital audio, and people have a hard time with it, and products are always trying to lower it.
Maybe we should start off by also saying what latency is.
Yeah, let's talk. You know what? That's probably
because it's not that complicated, really. It's just the time it takes for a digital audio signal to make it through a processor. Basically, I'm sure there's some correct technical explanation or definition of it, but what it basically amounts to is if you're recording through a digital audio system. It's the time that it takes the signal to get processed from when it enters the system to when it leaves the system. So, like, if you have a microphone hooked to a mic pre, hooked to an A to D converter, hooked to a computer,
right.
Each one of those steps, once it's in the digital world, each one of those steps introduces a little bit of delay, and that delay is called latency. And the way you most often notice latency is, like, if you're on a less expensive audio recording system,
right,
and you hook a microphone to it, you can talk into the mic and listen on headphones, and you'll hear a slight delay between the sound leaving your lips and what hits your ears. And that's because it's taking the processing of the computer some time to pass the signal through.
Right.
And generally, the way we get around that, there are two ways to get around it. One way is not to use any effects and to just use an audio interface that has the ability to just patch its inputs to its outputs. They usually call it zero latency monitoring.
Right. And so that the signal goes straight on through without.
Right. So you're not actually listening through your computer. You're just, the audio interface just hooks its ins to its outs, and the signal is going to the computer to be recorded, but you're not hearing it through the computer.
But that's just the input signal. What about if you have to play with, you know, a backing track like drums or a singer or things like that?
Well, a lot of systems are able to play those sounds out of their output, and within the audio interface, it can mix its inputs to those outputs as well. But so you can, if you have a system that does zero latency monitoring, you can hear what's coming out of your mouth or your instrument in real time with no latency, but it's not going through the computer, so you can't really hear any effects on it.
Right.
Or any processing.
But the second you throw a plugin in there, it...
Right. If you have to listen through the computer, there's going to be a delay. And any kind of plugin or processing from a plugin, it's going to introduce a delay.
I think what people don't understand or realize is some of these plugins, though, have massive amounts of latency. And you can always tell when you're working with an artist who likes a particular effect coming out of, like, the Cosmonaut plugin or mm-hmm. something, and they want to record with that on, you know, on their guitar. And
yeah,
it's
that
just,
doesn't work.
Yeah,
well, a lot like of these...
It's like a half second behind.
Yeah, well, a lot of the audio workstations now do what's called latency compensation,
right.
Which is they'll basically play back a sound early, so that by the time it goes through the plugin and has delay added to it, it's in time.
But that's only once it's recorded.
That's only once it's recorded. It doesn't work in real time.
Right. Now, Bobby, why don't we talk a little bit about delay compensation? I mean, do you use that? Well, I'm sure when
you do.
And when you're scoring, do you use that?
Yes.
Another part of latency, which is exactly the same thing, but sometimes people have virtual synthesizers or samplers, like you'd play a synthesizer sound in a computer. When you press the music, the MIDI keyboard, it would make the sound late as well, and that's the same concept as well. It's because it takes a while for the process to decide what sound it is and generate it, and that's also called latency. So the big problem with it is that, you know, music is, you know, when you play music, we all want to play in time. When we bash something, we want to hear it at the same time. When you sing into a microphone, you expect to hear it at the same time. So the only way around it, I use an analog console, so I don't really have that problem when I'm recording, but I do not use, if I'm recording a real person, I don't use digital DSP or, you know, plugins through the thing for that exact reason, because I find having a musician be able to hear themselves in real time, and I mean going through an analog monitoring console and an analog headphone set, because a lot of other things have latency, which I should alert you to, which is horrible, I think. Some speakers have amplifiers in them and they have digital input, but they've got a horrible little, like, 8 millisecond latency. So you think, oh, that's okay, I'm only mixing on them. It's like, yeah, but I want to do a vocal overdub and listen to them. It's just absolutely horrible. And even worse than that is a lot of guitar pedals have modeling, and they have, like, the pod and there's a lot of good ones. I mean, they sound fine, but for guitar players, I had a guitar player, actually had Kylo the other day doing some funky R&B style stuff, and he had a digital foot pedal thing. I said, do you mind if I give you one of my old analog boxes from 1972? And he plugged it in and he just started absolutely grooving on this. He said, man, this feels so good. Why is this feel so good? And I said, no latency. And he's like, you're right. That's exactly what it is. And everybody ends up feeling to have to compensate. You can't, I mean, great musicians do compensate, but it is a compensation.
Right.
And it's still not as good as if you hit the table, you feel that hit. Imagine hitting the table and you go, and it's late. It would be a horrible thing.
Right.
So you find a lot of modern musicians barely can clap in time anymore because they're always trying to play early. But to answer your question, yes, for composition and for scoring and stuff like that, my computer, I use Nuendo. It's got automatic latency compensation on it, meaning to say exactly what Rob spoke to. It calculates what plugins it's going through the audio that's been recorded. And it will work out, okay, I must play this X amount of milliseconds early.
Right.
And you can switch it on and off if you want it.
When you track, do you keep it on or do you turn it off?
I keep it on all the time.
So it has no problem even when you're tracking?
No, well, yeah, I mean, basically,
it just doesn't do anything.
It doesn't do anything. But again, you know, I'm using, I have about 5 millisecond throughput from MIDI to output, so it's not terrible.
But if you're tracking to a playback and the playback has some effect on it or something, obviously.
But you play to what you hear. So say, for example, Nuendo does do this. Say, for example, I had an audio two-track that the person was playing to, and I had it through a couple of boxes or compressors. Unless, of course, it's a delay that would be intentionally delayed. But say it's going through a compressor that takes processing time of, say, 23 milliseconds, for example. The audio, Nuendo automatically says, hey, it's going to go through this compressor. It takes 23 milliseconds to get through this. So when he presses play 23 milliseconds earlier. So what it will do is if I play at a certain point, it will actually buffer 23 milliseconds early and play it. So it's actually running ahead of
when you're playing.
It's reading from the hard drive before we're actually hearing.
And it does that on all the tracks.
All the tracks, exactly right. It's called latency compensation.
Because nowadays, more and more people are going to punch into their, you know, hey, we just want to add a guitar part to this one section. You know, and then that's where, you know, they can get really screwed up if they don't have their delay compensation on. And also buffers, though. Buffers really kind of affect how the latency is.
Well, and to explain buffers a little bit, buffers are the size of the chunk of data that your computer uses to process the digital audio. And the bigger the buffers, the less hard the computer has to work.
Right.
But the longer the latency, because basically you're hearing, you know, behind a buffer or two or whatever it's taking. But if you make the buffers smaller, the computer is processing smaller chunks at a time. The latency is better, but the computer has to work a lot harder.
Right.
And so in every audio application, that's always the balancing act. How big should the buffer be versus, how fast is the computer and how long of a delay are you willing to put up with?
Something that I do to get around that is, say you're working on a mix, you've got 30 tracks, a bunch of plugins, all kinds of stuff going on. You have to put your buffer up a little bit because it's eating so much processing power. And then you want to lay down, you know, a vocal track or a drum track or something. You just mix that all down to a stereo track, throw it in a new project, with, you know, nothing going on, basically, and then record in over that, and then bounce the other one back to there.
Nuendo has a feature called freeze, and if you have a track that's using a lot of processing power, you can press the freeze button, and it essentially digitizes it for you, so you can do exactly what you're saying and stay within the session and not bother.
Oh, yeah, Ableton can freeze, too.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool. You know, the one thing about...
I can freeze, too. Oh, sorry.
The one thing about latency is it seems like... You know, what people don't realize is some of those early digital boards had a tremendous amount of latency.
Horrible, they still do.
I mean, a big, giant, it seems like it was just a gap in the engineering. It was, you know, oh, yeah, what about this whole latency thing? Some famous boards from some big manufacturers.
Certainly.
Bobby, do you ever have any horror stories of finding out your board was... delayed?
No, because I've kind of stayed away from digital consoles, to be honest with you. I've played with them. I've tried them. I've reviewed them. But I haven't used them seriously because if you have analog, why bother? And frankly, until recently, I never felt that a digital console was the equivalent of a good analog console. Now, that being said, I should take some of this back because I do have a lot of experience on Euphonic System 5. And for a digital console, that's very analog feeling.
Right. It's a pretty fast console.
Yeah, it's pretty fast. But that's mostly been mixing and not so much tracking. You know, so the latency doesn't really factor in.
On the mixing side. You know, one thing that brought this up, other than the fact that right before we went to record, there was a tremendous amount of latency in our headphones. I'm setting up a new system over at where I mix, and not only do I have to deal with the delay of Pro Tools, but then we have HDMI, SDI to HDMI video converters that will delay the picture. So I'm running delay compensation on Pro Tools, plus I'm running another 16 quarter frame compensation for my picture to sync up. So as I'm mixing in my digital picture, they both hit at the same time.
That's something a lot of people don't realize is, you know, as we moved away from CRTs and into flat screens, there's a huge amount of latency in the picture.
Yes.
You know, from the time the TV gets the signal to the time it shows it or the video monitor. And especially like in the early days of plasma, it was horrendous.
Oh, yeah.
And still, depending on the set you have, LCDs and plasma still have a delay. And so one of the things you have to do when you're calibrating your studio and figuring out these things is figure out what your video delay is. And there's actually, I forget what it's called. You can look it up, but there is a cool little box that enables you to put like a beep and a video burst.
Hmm.
Through your system, and then it measures what the offset is between the two.
Oh, that's a new Russian dragon.
It's kind of like a Russian dragon, but it was not Russian cheap. Dragon. It was like $700 or $800, I think. But if you do it often, it's just a lifesaver. What I've done to do this, which is really kind of a kludge, is I'll make a video in Final Cut Pro that just has like a one frame white pop and a beep that goes with it, and then I'll set up a video camera in the room and video the screen and record the audio in the room too, and then take the video that camera captures, and I can see how far the sound is offset from the picture.
That's cool.
And that works. That's how I calibrate my room.
Do you calculate for the speed of light coming from the video?
I do not. You should do it. Anyway. Sorry. But that actually works, and it was quick and nasty, and I did it with stuff I already owned.
No, it's so true. It's something that you don't think about that often, is how fast your TV is. You know, how fast is your monitor?
It's a tricky thing because when you're editing sound effects, say, you're usually doing it on a freeze frame. Like if you're locking up a door slam with the picture, you're frozen on that door slam.
Right.
But then you'll go and play it back and it'll be out of sync because there's actually a delay when the video is playing in real time.
Right. And there's that. Go ahead.
How did you know it was 16 frames?
Because I...
Or 16
quarter frames.
I just kept adjusting the quarter frames until it looked in sync. And usually, like for me, it was, you know, on a hard two pop, you know, pop, and you can kind of, you can tell when it gets out of sync. And then when it lines up, it's like, in the pocket. It's like a good groove.
So you didn't actually look at the spec of the television then, right?
No.
You know what I did? And it was wrong.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah, I bought a Sony that said it was 3 milliseconds, and it was not.
Because the TV has a delay, but then the converter, because I'm coming off of HD cam and D5s coming out of SDI. So the SDI to HDMI out.
Cause yeah, the monitor, each step has a delay.
Yeah, that was the biggest culprit. And, you know, it's video people. They don't care about audio.
I will say one other thing about when we're tracking audio. It's one of the reasons that I like having a dedicated hardware DSP in a workstation, like with Pro Tools in my case, is that we can have all kinds of very low latency plugins running, and latency is not really an issue unless you're using some crazy effect.
Right.
But for basic EQs and compressors and things like that, you can get away with recording through the TDM plugins.
Yeah.
And we've been doing that for years, and it's been fine.
No, that's true.
The guys at Line 6 were telling me that when they first came out with the pod, all of the guitar players, and it wasn't, you know, the normal punters that would buy it. It would be the pros who would really complain about the latency on it. And they worked really hard to get the latency down. And it was some small number. I don't remember what it was. It was 2 milliseconds or something, you know, relatively small. And people are still complaining about it. And there's no way we can get it any lower. Yeah. You know, we've done everything we can. But what I was amazed was that, and I certainly didn't feel it myself as a guitar player, but there were some people that could feel, you know, that small of a latency. And it was incredibly small. I don't remember the number, but I just remember being
definitely the rhythm players, you know, when you get like a real pocket kind of guy that plays like really funky little. It's a feel. It definitely is. There's just a sidetrack, but it's slightly related. I used to do sound reinforcement. I used to work for a company, was the engineer for a while. And we used to have the delay lines, but we used to have a big band. We used to have a band, a single source, and we used to have, you know, towers, you know, 80 feet away or something like that. And that was a big pain in the butt because you used to have to delay the audio.
Right.
So it's in time because the guy hitting the snare drum, you see him hitting the snare drum, but you hear the sound late because it comes from the stage. So you have to attenuate the speakers on the stage source and increase the volume of these speakers so you would actually hear these speakers more than you'd hear those speakers, but the problem was the sound of the snare, say, coming from here, and the sound coming from there. This is not delayed, and you're standing here as a guy watching the show.
Right.
You start hearing a snare there, and then one there. You go, what the hell do I listen to? So, it's also a little tricky thing as well.
And then the other problem with that is the temperature changes everything. The temperature, and if there's fog rolls in or something,
changes the speed of the line. Well, you have different delay settings. Delta time, it was called.
And then nowadays, with the giant video screens that are being projected in the front, and yet.
But they delay those, though.
You're in the back.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just yet another thing.
They do delay the video so that it's in sync with the audio that takes a lot longer to get there.
They do. They attenuate as well. It's quite a trick attenuating a certain amount because the crowd does change. If it's outdoors, it's not so bad, but it is a pain. It's really a pain to get that all right. If they pop it out, you do 100 hertz and a 4K spike, and you beep, beep, brut, 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 beep, 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 as it goes in and out of phase. It's true. And then the wind blows it and it changes it. It's trippy. It's all sound.
Well, you know,
physics.
Latency is another thing that can really, if you can solve your latency issues, like Bobby was talking about the feel, it could really actually help you play better and get, you know, get a tighter groove. You know, you can really tighten things up. And also, when you're mixing, if you're not using delay compensation and your mixes are starting to sound a little foggy or something, you should find out, you know, what the delay is between the tracks, because you know all you need to do is pop in one VST or one audio unit or a plugin, and it can really, really tweak.
I'll definitely add to that, if you're mixing and you're not relying on any throughput, meaning to say you're not singing anything live, you should put your latency, your buffer size to as big as possible. Some plugins don't compensate for it, so be careful. So you can't just chuck it to, you know, as wide out as possible.
Right.
But some plugins can compensate for like 45 milliseconds or so. Put it up all the way so your CPU is not working that hard. It stops a lot of errors and clicks and pops if you do get to that stage and we start bogging it down. But most importantly, when you mix, if your application has it, you must definitely have delay compensation on, because what it does is it stops all audio from playing until it's perfectly in time and in sync with everything. So if you're talking about phase accurate parallel processing, if you're doing those sort of things, if you don't have that on, you won't ever get it to couple the same way because it'll be shifting depending how much work it is. So in the verse, if there's a big chunk of chorus going on, it'll be compensating in a different way. If there's no reverb or something on a patch in the verse, the tracks would play back at different times. So you really should put delay compensation on at all times if you're mixing.
One question I have is, why wouldn't you use delay compensation?
CPU.
It does bog down the computer. It does bog down the computer. It's a lot more work for the computer.
And it sounds funky. It starts to get clicky and you start to get a grainy sort of... When the CPU starts to work hard, you get so many errors that go past. We don't hear it, but it starts to get really munchy.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, not like a distortion type of thing.
Yeah.
It can be.
Yeah. You start getting a CPU to work hard, and you'll start to get all sorts of... You go back and look at the thing, you start to see all sorts of little nasty spikes going through, and you go, wow, didn't even hear it. It's just going... You know, if you drop a sample, you don't really hear it.
Right.
But you're dropping them. You're dropping that data. The thing's going, I can't do this right now. And your little red light goes on your CPU process, like...
Hey. See, I've never gotten mine to redline. Maybe I...
Because you've got a big computer, maybe.
I guess because I just suck, but... but I've never got it up that... Even on some of the big mixes that I do, but it'd be interesting to hear.
Well, you know, just changing the subject a little bit, but staying with latency, latency's been used for a really long time in mastering.
Sure.
Where it's been...
Stop having needles.
Well, in the beginning, what they did, when you're talking about vinyl, in order to get the compressors to work, the limiters to work, so you didn't destroy, you know, cutting heads and discs and stuff like that, you had a tape machine that had these funny delays on, and you know, and basically you had a funny signal path. And what it would do, it would delay the signal enough that the limiter could actually catch the transients before anything happened.
It's like analog look-ahead limiting?
Analog look-ahead limiting. That's exactly
cool.
What it was.
That's tricky.
And it was a special mastering deck that you had. But now, when we come into the digital age, we have look-ahead limiting. Mm-hmm. And the look-ahead function is a 2 millisecond or so built-in delay,
right,
where the limiter can catch the transients before they actually happen, before they do any damage. So if you look at latency from the standpoint of it can do good as well as evil, you know, mm-hmm, there's a perfect case where it's actually, well, maybe this is evil, but it's helped us get the levels that we get, the crazy levels,
right,
because that's the only way that you can really jack the sound up as much, jack the level up on something, because you have the look-ahead limiter.
Wow, that's...
Because it's already geared to know what's coming down the pike. It's like,
right,
okay, this is going to be really loud. Let me just control this right now.
You know, it's just amazing that how... You know, basically when we talk about latency, we're talking about timing. And we've talked about timing the last time we talked about groove. But just how, you know, small changes in the timing of things can really affect the feel or the sound or just the overall quality. I mean, basically, look at clocking. Look at, like, Big Ben hooked up to Pro Tools. You know, especially when we put together Martin system, you know, the 192 with just... On its own, it sounded okay. You put the Big Ben out there, it just everything was tight. It just like locked everything together. It was just all tight. And that, you know, that's probably a really small, tiny number that we're talking about as far as being effective.
Well, speaking of which, one thing I'd kind of like to ask everybody, what master clocks are you all using?
Well, a Big Ben.
A Big Ben?
Yeah.
What do you use?
I use Prism, the Prism ADA.
I don't have a need for one right now. Just using all...
I've got Timex.
Mike, you're using one?
Not syncing.
Big Ben,
anything.
Yeah.
Big Ben. There's one... I just heard a bunch of people talk about it, that it's really hot. It's out of Nashville, and I can't think of the name of it right off the top of my head. An Atomic Clock something, an Atomic Clock 2, something like that.
I heard talk about that, too.
And everybody says that it's... going to the next level beyond a Big Ben, which is hard to imagine, but...
I'm sure. I mean, it is the most... I mean, jitter and noise and wander of a clock signal is massive for sonics.
I mean, we're way past the point that most people can hear the difference, obviously, but they just keep improving the precision of the clock. Another really good one is the Brainstorm, the DCD-8.
Yeah.
I use that. I have the Prism feed it, and then it feeds all the gear, because I'm feeding word clock to, I don't know, like, 30 or 40 devices, so I need to split it out because I try to daisy chain stuff as little as possible.
What do you use to split your word clock out?
The DCD-8.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, has, I guess, 8 out, and then I very carefully made sure each chain was terminated exactly right so that I can go out 2, 3, 4 devices on each chain, and it's okay.
Maybe we should explain what word clock is. So
yeah, word clock is just basically the simplest way to get digital clocking information between digital audio devices. So there have been all different clock schemes over the years, but word clock, it just travels over video cable. And as long as you have your cable terminated properly, the same way you would with a video signal with 75 ohms at the end, it's a really reliable clock. Definitely much more reliable than asking your devices to get their clock from their audio input. You know, a lot of people just plug the output of one device into the input of the next and let the second device get its clock from that input. It's a much better thing, much more stable to have everybody get word clock if they support it.
And word clock's essentially sample rate, let's just say. If you're running something at 48K, which is a common sample rate, you'd have your word generator, word clock at 48K, and that would give your hardware a clock. You just put in an external mode.
Right. And it's a very simple clock. It's just on, off, on, off, on, off at the right speed. Yeah.
What's really amazing is if you've never heard a system without a word clock and then you put a word clock on it, it's amazing how it changes your perception of just your system, because it tightens everything up. I mean, that's the best way I could say it. It like puts it all in focus. It was a little blurry, but you tighten it up with a good clock and shoof, it just gets all nice and tight.
And make sure the clock is terminated right.
There's a real secret there.
It's a real secret. Yeah. And there are some devices. One of the reasons I love the DCD-8 is you can go through the screen and it'll tell you on each of its word clock chains what the termination, resistance is. So, like, I'll step through my chain and it'll show, okay, this one's 75 ohms, this one's 74 ohms, and it's very accurate. And then it'll show, okay, this one is double terminated or triple terminated, and it'll actually say on the screen, that chain is double terminated. And then sure enough, you go and you'll see that some of the devices have their termination on. There are some devices, whose termination is funny if they're not turned on.
Right. And the reason for termination is just so you have a constant load at the end of the wire, so that you don't get sort of like a bounce back. So you don't get a bounce back sound, basically. It's not sound, but sign if you don't get the clock coming back down the cable.
I got
you. It actually stops at one end.
And having that kind of bounce back is as bad as not having a
clock. Because you have two clocks, so it's the ones that
and some of those devices, don't they have built-in auto terminations on some devices?
They do, yeah.
They do, but some of them don't work when the device is off. It's the weirdest thing. I have some sample rate converters from Roland which have a physical switch to turn the termination on and off, and yet if the device is off, the termination is wrong.
Really?
Yeah,
it's like a diff. It's a diff. It's a differential resistor, basically. It needs electricity to hold the thing up. You can switch it in and out. Yeah, that's a dumb idea.
Well, and until I had the DCD-8, I didn't know that because, you know, I just didn't know that.
Well, hey, listen, we're going to terminate this discussion.
Very good.
Hey, how's that?
What a segue.
Hey.
Oh.
Must be 75 ohms already.
No, but I just wanted to talk about something and that I think people have to understand about latency and just timing, because it's in the digital world, it's only going to get more and more important to you as your system expands and grows and just really understanding how to make latency work with you. Because it always wants to work against you.
But you know what? The other good thing is as computers and interfaces get faster, it'll become less and less of a problem. I mean, there's always going to take some amount of time to process an audio signal. But compared to where it was you know, a few years ago to now and where it's going, because computers are getting faster, latency goes down.
There was at one time with Pro Tools, I think, you could record something, go get a cup of coffee, come back, and then listen to it come out of your speaker.
Wow.
That's how bad the latency was.
You could record a song, and then you'd have to wait to hear it on the radio.
That's really funny.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is going to be a good place for us to break, so we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to continue our discussion. No, we're not. We're not going to talk about latency. We're going to talk about some other things, and we'll see you on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about latency. And during the break, we got to talking about slates.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
See, guys,
tiles, slates.
You're not missing a thing off the air. Just the conversation is Rob did some slates.
Yeah, for some radio spots. Does anyone even know what slates are anymore?
Does anybody ever use them besides radio people?
I don't know.
Why don't you television
spots, sure.
We do for trailers, television spots.
Yeah, but
like
vocal
audible slates.
You don't do audible slates.
Audible slates.
Yeah. No, these are audible
video slates.
Is just where you basically identify what the following piece of audio is. You know, if it's a commercial, you'll give the ad agency name, the name of the commercial, the product, the date, and maybe a few other little specifics about it. And the thing is, I can understand why on a for a radio commercial they might want it, although can't they just read the file name?
Yeah, I'm exactly the same way. It's like, why go through all that when you can just look at the file
often
name?
Often the file name gets, the documentation gets lost, or it's badly marked or wrong.
That's true, because in the old days they could have read the tape box the same way, but the tape would often get separated from the box.
Okay.
Fascinating stuff. We should do about 6 hours on slates. Make it like our first mini-series.
The advantage goes off.
And get Jeremy to do like a two-hour slate before it goes on.
2 hour slate. Good old slates. Wow. All right. Well, thank you for listening to the podcast. And the thing I like about slates is going to be the last thing I want to say about slates. When I record slates, it's like, it feels like kind of broadcasty. It feels like, wow, you're kind of doing like, you know, for goodness manufacturing, such and such and such. You give the ISKI numbers. I don't know. It's just something different for me.
It's a showbiz moment for
you. I know.
You.
It's a showbiz moment.
You have arrived. Reproduce a test tape. Catalog number 572.
Remember that? Remember that?
Announcing the nanowebers.
Yeah. 320 nanowebers. 1,000 kilohertz.
Boop. We actually... Second to last story about slates.
We're doing a whole hour on slates.
When we do slates over where I mix, sometimes I'll bring somebody else to read the slates, and what I'll do is I'll pitch them up, and what ended up happening is we would just be messing around with the slates and all that. That we actually got this this routine going between me and the producer who was doing the slates, and we called it Angry Mouse, and we did like 7 episodes, and they're hilarious because it's all the bantering, and it sounds like a bunch of angry mice. It was pretty funny. Okay, we'll move forward.
Maybe we could get like an up-and-coming slate artist on the podcast to sit in. Someone who's just dreamed their whole life of just doing slates.
All right. Well, anyhow, enough of that.
Actually, sounds like we already got him.
What can I say?
We must have something almost as fascinating to talk about, though.
No, we do. I got an email from a listener, and I wanted to bring it up. And we had talked a little bit about this, but we haven't talked about it in a long time. And this kind of came to me. I was driving back from AES from San Francisco to LA, and I had a moment where I could listen to about 6 hours of just my iPod and listening to all kinds of great music and everything, and I realized how many different artists were out there that really influenced me in the way I mix and the way I compose and what I do, and at the same time this email came in actually on that day, and they wanted to find out what were some of our influences. And so I thought, you know what, that's actually something pretty cool. We get really technical on the podcast, but I'm going to open it up and, you know, I'm going to find out, you know, some of the artists that kind of made you who you are. And let's start with you, Bobby. Summerfield.
Yes, sir. Okay, very good. Carry on. Good evening.
Talk about some of your influences people that have really made an impact on what you do and
okay, it's a good question.
How you write.
It's a good question. I think when I was very young, and I had an older sister who loved the Beatles, and and a lot of R&B and funk. So I just got Beatles and that stuff just really when I was 4 and 5. And my mum liked Frank Sinatra and that sort of stuff. And my dad liked big band jazz. So I had all this music floating around the house, which was great. So that was I didn't know, but I was being influenced by that. And so I grew up liking that sort of stuff. So I gravitated towards that sort of music from the music side of point of view. So I loved the Beatles, of course, and I loved all that whole 60s through 70s rock sort of songwriting style. So that was very that affected me for the style of music. Then when the 70s and 80s came around, I loved the funk and R&B and the disco stuff. I really liked that. From a technical point of view, I really liked some of the nice producers like Trevor Horn. You know, it could be can't really go anywhere without saying, you know, most of his stuff was yardstick stuff for me. I literally studied his stuff. I loved Quincy Jones from a different sort of point of view, but from a pure engineer's point of view, I loved, you know, all those, you know, the Trevor Horn era. That was a really top class era, along with towards the end of, you know, sort of 80s, like the beginning, sorry, of the 80s, 81, 82, where I think that music recording kind of peaked because it was like the best of what recording and technology was, right, in an organic sense, and at best of what musicianship was at getting it on tape and the production thing. I think that was kind of like the peak of and that's really what I draw from. So to answer your question, because of course you want to know more from a technical point of view, I would say like listening to all the great producers, and Trevor Horn would be the main guy I like because not always... He always put a very heavy stamp on what he did. I wouldn't think that's the best way to produce a record, but I liked his technical, right, people that he had around him, and so I thought that was one of the guys.
And what about, do you have people that inspire you nowadays that you listen to? Nowadays it doesn't even have to be music. I mean, it can be video, it can be film. There's so many ways to get, like, I get inspired by a lot of different things. There's some writers that I read their books and I'm like, oh, this is amazing. I mean, what kind of other things kind of influence you even?
You know, these days, I listen to, you know, inspire me. That's unfortunately a sad thing. Not that much. I'll be honest. I mostly get inspired when I hear older music these days because I'm old. I mean, really do. But, you know, like the other night I heard, I can't remember the name of the track. No, it was a Curtis Mayfield track. And it came on, it was just screaming. And it was nothing to be inspired by. Nothing to be inspired by other than realizing how hard it is to get such a great sounding record and a great sounding beautiful performance captured like that, that just stands the test of time, including the vocal, the singing, the production, the recording with all the limitations. So unfortunately, a lot of the modern, I don't get inspired that much about modern stuff, but I will say some of the, recently I just, as I said, I've been working with Robbie Williams and I've been listening to his stuff because I had to study his stuff sort of, right, kind of, and Trevor Horn just did his record before the one I was involved with. So, and I listened to that and I again then started to listen to his other stuff. And I think he's done some really well, good stuff, really well crafted stuff. To say it was inspiring, I respected it. I liked a lot of what BT did for a stage. Right. BT did a lot of nice stuff because he had a nice quirky kind of editing kind of style, which is really nice. But to be honest, I'm sort of out of the loop with being inspired by a lot of the new stuff because I don't really hear enough of it. But also I do negate a lot of it because I go, I've heard that before. I kind of get bored of it. And lots of the stuff is just so overly compressed and unmagical that I just don't, it doesn't inspire me. So I'll be honest with that. You know.
Did you ever have an aha moment? Was there ever a moment when you were growing up where you're like, you saw something or heard something and thought, yep, I want to do this because of that.
Yeah, right. I really dissected a lot of the, you know, Michael Jackson era. I mean, that the Quincy stuff, I mean, a lot of his stuff, I used to put two speakers together and put them out of phase,
right,
and put a vinyl record cover in between them and hear what the separation was and hear what they were doing. And then I had a little studio and I used to do Sum and Difference on stuff.
I'm laughing because I just thought of that Facebook picture.
That's terrible, right? Everybody's the bro with the fro.
Have you seen that, the Facebook? I'll have to show it to you guys. It's hilarious.
The Bella Napoli. I was 1982, and I was into R&B and funk, and I was like a white bro with a fro.
You did?
I was like, yeah, what's up?
That's really awesome.
It's funny.
Brandon, what about you? Did you ever have an aha moment, or what inspired you back then, or what inspires you now? What's just some of your influences?
Well, way back then, I mean, it was definitely, I remember the first time I heard Led Zeppelin and Whole Lot of Love, that breakdown section with you know, screaming and the drums going on, and that just, like, it was weird, and I was like, you know, seven. It was weird and scary and, like, very awesome, and I loved it. And I remember that really got me into deeper, to dig deeper into music, and the classic rock got me into blues and all that stuff. And then, but currently, I don't know, 8 years ago or so, I took more of a turn into the electronic stuff. And currently I love, this year I was, we were just talking at work about our favorite albums of 2010. And I have to say, top of my list is Trent Moeller, the electronic, the Dutch electronic producer. Really, really amazing stuff. Sound quality, really, really good. Just interesting ideas musically and everything. That, I'm loving that right now. Jonesy from Sigur Rós is I'm a big fan of his, doing some really, really amazing, really organic, cool stuff right now.
Nice.
And who else this year was great? The French group Air, always, their stuff is always incredible. Massive Attack put out a great album this year. Really, really good stuff as usual from them. But all those people, a lot of them are called electronic, but they use it. I find the good electronic artists use a ton of organic material. You know, it's, they're recording things, and yes, it's electronic, but they're, you know, they're recording real drums, they're recording real samples, and using all that. So that's really what's inspiring me right now. Love that stuff.
Rob.
Yes, Mike.
Some of your influences, Rob. What makes you tick? What makes Rob
I
Rob?
Wish I knew.
And even, you know, music, but also, you know, with your just your technical savvy. I mean, there has to be some type of inspiration that goes into just some of the stuff you do on the tech side, because some of your tech stuff is just genius. Sorry, while I gush for a little bit.
You know, when I was a kid, we used to just gather around, and my father would bring home reels and reels of old radio commercials, and we would just listen to the slates. And we just sit around and compare notes.
And slate along.
And slate along. And the holiday slates around Christmas. It was awesome. No, for me, my influences were totally Motown, really. And, I mean, I was a huge Supremes fan and a huge Stevie Wonder fan. I mean, when I was 2 or 3 years old, I used to just park myself in front of the speakers at my grandmother's house and just listen to, you know, these albums over and over and over and over and over, which is why, you know, when I got a little older and had the opportunity to drop out of school and meet Stevie, my parents realized they should probably encourage this, because I was doing it either way. Because he was my total musical hero growing up. So, and it's funny, because by the time I started touring with him, you know, I'd often play the keyboards for soundcheck, as you remember.
Right.
And I'd play all his parts, because I'd been listening to his stuff since I was a little kid. I mean, I knew his songs completely inside and out. And then also around the house, I mean, my father is a huge Sinatra fan, and there was big band stuff playing, and Beatles and all the stuff.
Funny.
So a lot of
it's
same influences that you
haven't,
had.
We haven't.
No, we've never discussed.
Never discussed this.
But I even remember as a kid, my father brought the whole family to see Sinatra in Philadelphia. So I remember seeing him live. I must have been 10 years old or something.
And we both like Rush as well. We should say that.
Huge fan. You know what's even better than Rush? The Slate at the beginning of some of their masters. You listen to that. It seems like the following song totally sucks. And it's presented at 33 and a third up. Yeah. No, but it's funny, because as a composer, you know, I've ended up having to do a lot of different music styles. And I studied classical piano from when I was a little kid, but it was never really my passion for what to listen to. But I've gotten to do big band stuff. I've gotten to do tons of funk and R&B stuff, you know, scoring for commercials and trailers and films and stuff. And that's what I fall into most naturally. And it has to be because I've been listening to it since before I could really talk.
Wow.
Just built in.
And I know I've said this on the podcast many times, but When I used to tour with Rob, he would play Stevie's parts just note for note. It was amazing. It really was. You were the best. Other people try to play Stevie's parts, but Rob can play Stevie's parts.
The most annoying thing to me whenever we would be on the road and at the end of a gig or whatever, we'd all go back to the hotel, and if there was a bar band or, you know, a lobby pianist or something in the hotel, they'd see Stevie walk in, and of course they want to play one of his songs. And nothing used to drive me more bonkers than having them play his songs in their key but not his key.
Right. Because
especially if we're, you know, we're hearing these songs every single night.
And they do it in C.
Yeah, exactly. They're doing Superstition in C. And it's just all you can do to keep your dinner down. But, you know, they're trying to be nice.
Right.
But, and I understand why they do it in their own key, because if Stevie sits down to play and everybody tries to sing along, their head explodes because his voice, his range is impossible.
He did the other night over there.
But did you ever, when you were doing a sound check and you're sitting at key at Stevie's piano, did you ever have this moment of like, oh my gosh, here I am sitting at Stevie's piano playing his part for sound check? I mean, that would just,
I mean, I did it so many hundreds of times that I got used to it. But you know, the one time that it was absolutely just the super awesomest, if that is a word.
Very super awesomest.
It was pretty super awesome. We were at Radio City Music Hall, and my parents and some of my siblings drove up from Philly and came to sound check. And so they sat in the front seat at Radio City Music Hall. The place is basically empty.
Right.
While I'm on stage playing with Stevie's band, you know, Nate and everybody right. behind. And so we basically ran through a giant chunk of the show, and they got to sit there and watch me play through the whole show. And I'm looking out and I'm seeing my parents and family sitting in the front row, and I'm looking out and seeing Radio City Music Hall.
Yeah.
And, you know, Stevie's band, these same players. I mean, Nate, you know, he played I Wish, the song I grew up thinking was the coolest bass line in history. And I'm sitting on stage at Radio City Music Hall playing with all these people. And no one's really thinking anything of it. I mean, my parents are about to explode, you know, with joy and pride and everything. But everybody else, we're just jamming and having fun because we'd already done it a zillion times and we were still yet to do it a zillion times.
Right.
But I would say that was the most amazing moment, because also I remember it was a particularly incredible sounding sound check.
Wow.
And everybody was just on.
Wow.
And it, that was pretty great.
That's awesome. That is cool.
And that's in 1986 or 7. That's a long time ago.
Wow. Bobby.
Yeah.
How about you, Bobby O?
You know, I've been sitting here listening to everybody and thinking how I'd reply to this. And really, I agree with Bobby a lot. I've been influenced by many of the same things, you know, the Beatles and Motown, where you know, you just, and Stax was the other thing.
Yeah.
I loved everything coming out of Stax. But the more I think about it, the first musical memory I have is on the radio, and I don't know how old I was, but Ray Charles. And then I remember when I was very young, my parents taking me to Atlantic City, to the boardwalk, and seeing Louis Armstrong.
Wow.
Wow.
And very, very subtle influences, where at the time you don't realize how influential it is, and later on you realize. When I started playing bands, there was one guy, nobody will know who he is, but I have to mention him anyway. His name is Jim Strahacker. And he was a singer that I played with in a horn band. It was a cover band of Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears and stuff like that. And he gave me the first really good piece of musical advice. And, you know, I've always gone on this quest. Why does something sound the way it sounds? Why does a band sound good and another one doesn't? Why does one drummer sound really good and another one doesn't? You know, and sometimes you can analyze all you want, but it's really difficult to get, you know, down to the essence of why something is happening or why it isn't. Anyway, you know, coming back to the band thing, Jim Strahacker, who's unfortunately passed recently, he pounded into my head that how important dynamics were. Dynamics, 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 dynamics. And if you don't do anything else, if you play dynamically, the audience is going to love you. And it's true. you know, you could really play badly, and if you play dynamically, there's something special that you're doing. And one of the things we do when we make records is we, if we do it well, we make them dynamic. And of course, it's the intensity of the players, how intense they're playing, but it's also how we're adding parts, how we're layering everything, the arrangement dynamics. But if you think of all of that, that was one of the most important pieces of advice I ever got, and it was from somebody who wasn't famous. And it really sticks with me till today. If we roll up on the technical side of things, it would be Tom Holman, who, Tom Holman is kind of the godfather of surround sound. The THX is his baby. It's Tom Holman Experiment,
right.
Everybody knows about. And Tom was a huge influence. When I started to experiment with surround sound, and everybody else thought I was a nut, Tom was the one guy who said, oh, wait, maybe you have something. And while I was questioning some of the standards that were being used at the time, Tom was one of the guys that said, well, okay, yeah, I see where you're coming from. So he was a really big influence. And now I kind of have retrograde influences. And what I mean by that is I constantly meet heroes of mine that I grew up listening to, either people that were players, the writers, the artists, or the engineers or producers, of songs and acts that we knew growing up. And I'm lucky enough to meet them now. And when I hear the stories, it's a huge influence. Only because, I understand why things sound the way they sound. I understand, a really good friend of mine now is Ken Scott, who is one of the four Beatles engineers.
Yeah.
And we're actually going to write a book together.
Hmm.
And Ken describes the whole Beatle experience and eliminates some of the myths and really gets down to why things happen. And it's, meeting people like that is a big influence on me today. And like I say, it's retrograde because it's all the stuff that's happened in the past. But nonetheless, meeting them is still, it's a big deal to me.
Can I add that, unfortunately, and maybe it's just an observation, but yourself, Bobby, and Rob and myself, and less so because you're younger than us, but unfortunately we are all retrospect. Well, we're looking back. Is that, and it's a question more than an observation, I suppose, but it's because we're old, or is it because what we have behind us is better than what's in front of us?
Yeah. It's very hard to know the exact answer to that question, but it just seems
to
me...
Something.
Well, but you know what? It seems to me... 20 years from now, the groups that Brandon mentioned...
will be classics.
No, my guess is more likely, because they're so in the moment, they'll be gone.
Ah.
They're not... The thing that generations hook onto are songs and messages and lyrics and those kinds of things. And instrumental stuff comes and goes. And there will always be fans who will dig stuff up from the past, but... The stuff we're talking about, I mean, the Beatles are going to be just as big in 20 years as they are now. A lot of the Motown stuff, especially because there's no one really doing it. Although CeeLo's album is awesome. If you want to talk about something from this year, it's a really good album.
What's it called, the song again?
F you.
No, but Rob, I think you make a great point, because I'm a huge electronica fan, but I think... there's going to be, in 20 years, the sounds that we hear nowadays are going to sound kind of dated, and electronica will be on a different plateau.
Well, it has a shelf life like milk. I mean, it's gone so quickly. I mean, think back when we were about Brandon's age. Gary Newman came out with that song Cars, and that was like the most cutting edge, bizarre electronic. Oh my God, he's got mascara on, the world's going to end.
Right.
That was like the trippiest, weirdest thing in the world. And now you look back and yeah, it gets licensed for commercials, so the next generation knows it. But you look at what he looked like and what it sounded like, and it's a cute, kitschy, picture of the way things were 20 years ago or however long ago it is.
Right.
But it's not like it's not like anybody takes it super seriously or anything. It was a cute fashion that was hot for a minute and went, and it's nostalgic and cool to look back on it, but and actually in a lot of ways it was kind of groundbreaking.
Yeah, it was.
But you think of how many other records were around during that same time period that are long forgotten. And those things, they get dredged up occasionally, you know, they get licensed for something and then they get another following. But I think a lot of the stuff that's out today, especially instrumental stuff, it's going to be the same kind of flash in the pan-ish effect that it was for that same kind of music 20 years ago.
Although I will say there's going to be, as technology gets better and sounds get better, because quite frankly, the electronic music nowadays sounds so much better than the
original. Yeah, but you know what? In history, no one cares how it sounds. They care how it moves them emotionally. And you'll remember where you were when you heard something, and that's your connection.
You look it up, but look at like Daft Punk Discovery. I mean, that's going to be.
But Daft Punk is awesome.
That's going to be a classic that's going to live on for.
Yeah, but they're better than most. They're a lot better than
us. That's true, but there's some, you know, there's some other ones. I mean, even some of BT stuff, I think, will last, you know, a moment in
emotional technology.
Just something as simple as Smart Bomb, I think, will be will have some legs and things like that. So I think
they'll have some. I don't know.
It's very hard to get emotional. You know, I don't know, but if you listen to a really good, when I listen to a song, and the lyrics and the performance and the music strikes me a certain way, I don't get the same connection as when I listen to a computer generated.
See that, and that's so wrong, because the electronic music can have the same type of emotion, can actually build like anticipation, can have, you know.
That's the basic part of it, but there's a deeper cry when you hear a singer sing something that's not pitch corrected, and they're actually, whatever it is. I mean, yeah, whatever that performance is, there's just like an emotional connection that you have with a human. It's more, it's stronger than I don't know.
I think it's the what you do with the tool. I don't think it's the tool itself.
You know what, though?
I agree with you, Mike.
Yeah, it's not the tool itself, but also we don't, you know, you can never predict the future, and we don't have that much history of electronic music yet to go back on. But if you go back, and if you're around in the 70s and 80s, there was plenty of great songwriting and great songs, and there was also plenty of instrumental stuff, some of electronics and some of it not. And we can see, you know, 20 or 30 years from, you know, have passed since then, and we can see what has withstood the test of time. A lot of the great lyrical vocal songs are still, in some ways, almost as popular as they were back then. And the instrumental stuff, even though it made huge connections with people back then, it doesn't make those same connections now. It just doesn't. People latch on to songs and emotion and meaning. And the thing that
I think songs being the word is this, it's a vocal. It's
well, but you know what else people latch on to? They latch on to where they were in their life when they heard a song. So you could hear something that's electronic and even just purely instrumental. But if you happen to hear that song for the first time, you know, during some really traumatic moment in high school or whatever, you're going to have a connection to that song that other people may never even understand. But your connection is with yourself at that time. It's not with the song itself. And the easiest connection is with a song, with lyrics and a performance.
But you do realize that electronic music, there are songs. They are songs. It's not like they're just, there are definitely some of the, you know, circuit bent type of music that is a bunch of tones and is loosely resembles a song. But most of your good electronic music is songs and
for example, those bands I was mentioning, they don't really, they're not your dance it up electronic. These are songs.
I mean, look
at, you know,
if you look at what's Something About Us, Daft Punk. It's just
that's a great little
organ part that's just synthesized. Sounds
well,
like
they're
an organ.
Incredibly, incredibly talented. Daft Punk is just really, really good. And the groups that Brandon mentioned, I don't know all of them, but I know some of them, and they're really, really good. But it's like any other genre. They're the ones who are really talented and the ones who are not so talented.
Well, and I think also, I think there's generations that are going to. Each generation will hold precious what it thinks is precious at that time. You know what I mean?
Well, except you do find a lot of current generations holding
stuff Precious from before they were born.
That's true, but it's not like there's a limited amount of preciousness. I mean, things can just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I think there's room much before the Beatles were there. Before even rock and roll existed, you had music that had lasted, up to that moment. And then as soon as, rock and roll was invented and this new sound, and you get the Elvis songs kind of join that. And then the Beatles come along and that kind of joins that. And every generation, and then ELO comes along and joins that. And, I like ELO. But, what I'm saying? I just think there's going to be the artists, the electronic artists that are going to join out. There's going to be the dance artists. Some of the DJs that are out there that do their remixes are going to kind of find a cult following in a few years, I mean, I don't know. I just think each generation is going to learn how to listen to things and understand music at their own time,
It seems like, there are plenty of young people discovering current music, but it still seems like if you look at the music search demographics and you look at sales, you've got a lot of really young people discovering the same exact music that was popular when we were kids.
Yeah, I see
that. Much bigger trend towards that than there is towards any excitement around.
It's true. It's human artists. Connection. We're humans. We dig humans. I mean, irrespective. I mean, it truly. I think it's
no. I understand what you're saying, and you're correct. We just can't throw these broad labels, though.
Have you had an electronic song make you cry? Have you? Because if you go and hear a choir sing, and I'm not saying it's a classical sense, but if you hear six people sing, it'll actually make you shiver, and you go, man, that's a connection. And that's deeper than before music. It's our core. It's our core essence of human.
I'm going to answer your question answering the question that I brought up to you guys about what influences you. And I'm going to tell you what influenced me. And when I was a kid, I grew up and I listened to a lot of Christian music. My father was a pastor and we listened to a lot of Christian music. And there's this producer named Ralph Carmichael who, my dad bought this record of the, Hallelujah chorus done on a Moog, modular system. And it was actually the Messiah, the Christmas part of the Messiah. Done all on this Moog modular thing. And I wore this thing out. The sounds were so amazing because I'd never heard anything like that. It just blew me away. And it was it was Handel's Messiah done on a Moog modular. And it changed my life. There was two moments that I totally remember.
Your own personal little NAMM show going on.
it was amazing. I'll tell you how much I was into that album. When I was a kid, we used to do these every New Year's Eve. We'd do these talent shows, and all my brothers and sisters would do a talent. And my talent that year was I had a kazoo, and I played along with Handel's Messiah done on a Moog modular.
You're being the Moog synthesizer.
That's right.
He's a sawtooth.
Exactly. And I had the kazoo because it sounded kind of like similar, And it was life changing. And so that kind of got me into electronic music and synthesizers. And then, I remember the first time I saw Tron. See, I'm wearing a Tron shirt right now, by the way. The first time I saw Tron just blew me away. It was just like, I want to do something along those lines. The animation blew me away. I was a kid and I'll just never forget just being so, amazed at what I was seeing and what I was hearing with the original, the sound effects of the light bikes and all that. It just really influenced me. And that kind of got me the whole digital bug the synthesis bug and then that's why I latched onto groups like Saga and I latched onto some of the great keyboard bands, Asia was a great keyboard band.
You've just named it. There's two rushes in a row right there.
Don't throw anything around. No, but seriously, I loved all that. And so it, because it, to me, you could hear, there's nothing like when I first got my first Juno 60 and I put a a soft pad on, and I set the filters so that I rolled up all the high end, and it was just, it sounds like it's coming from the next room. I mean, that, putting headphones on and you're playing chords on that thing, that's emotional. I mean, that's like, that just gave me chills. And yeah, I mean, I've never been moved to tears per se by an electronic sound, but I don't get moved to tears.
But no, but actually,
but there's definitely
the
emotion,
point,
and
the point,
definitely.
I mean, there's a subtle difference. There's a subtle difference when you hear a singer, you hear Janis, and your hair stands up on end. She's dead 25 years, or maybe longer than
31 years.
And you don't get that with computer music. And I love computer music. Believe me, I love electronic music. I love playing and doing and screwing around with synth myself. But I still don't ever get that connection.
But what how are we defining electronic music? I mean, a lot of the stuff I'm talking about has vocalists.
Are we talking Massive Attack?
Exactly.
I mean, Massive Attack's got some great stuff. I mean,
yeah,
absolutely.
Lilith Fraser with Massive Attack Teardrop. I mean,
definitely.
Even like, listen to Aerodynamic when those arpeggiators kick in and stuff like that. I mean, there's some great stuff that even nowadays, I mean, that's, 10, 15 years ago, and that stuff, it's not sad emotion, but it definitely can give you an emotion. It can, definitely can, like, get you going.
But you are right that there's nothing like a voice.
No, there's nothing. You're right. I'll give you
a
that.
Singer,
I'll give
one
you that.
Singer can actually... They'll bring out much more emotion, and you don't get that from a lot of music these days because it's diluted. It's perfected and filtered and processed and munched around.
You know what? You're absolutely right.
I mean, that's fortunate. I mean, I'm talking about a very subtle thing, but
I'll tell you, a modern influence. Well, first of all, as far as nowadays, just being influenced, like tech-wise, most of the guys around here, you guys all influence me in your own way,
They make you cry, too.
No! Getting to know Rob, because Rob is just the human dictionary when it comes to electronic, not electronic music, but when it comes to synthesized and MIDI. I mean, I learned a lot from Rob from working with him.
Absolutely.
And then first time I saw your studio, Bobby, that was just really cool. It was a great little setup. And Brandon and all your amazing swooshes. This guy's a swoosh king, by the way.
Das Swooshenmeister.
And then I read Bobby's books, but tons of stuff there. And you know who else? Martin.
Pagey, yeah.
It's been such a pleasure to get to know Martin as a friend because he was, I remember the first time I was working with him and he was playing me some stuff that wasn't on his album and just some stuff that he wrote. And it was just amazing to hear, from the songwriters to some of these roughs and some of these comps and stuff like that. It's just, for me, it was an aha moment. I remember when I was hanging out with Martin the first time and he's showing me some of this stuff. Cause it's like, it's just, I feel grateful that there are people that can do that kind of stuff and that can just write some great songs. And so you're right. It all comes down to, there's something about the human connection. I will definitely give you that.
You know what? I just remembered what it was that made me want to get my first synthesizer. Because it was actually a huge influence on me, but I just hadn't thought about it in a long time.
Was it Rush?
It was not.
Oh.
That's what made me want to get my first weapon. No, it was when I was a little kid, we went to, I guess it was Disney World. I don't think it was Disneyland. I think it was Disney World. We had driven down to Florida to visit my grandparents because that's the law when you have, elderly Jewish grandparents. And so we went to Florida. We went to Disney World. And saw the Electric Light Parade.
Oh, yes.
And I just remember being a little kid and hearing music coming from everywhere.
Yes.
Just every tree had music, every cloud, every rock. Everything had this incredible arrangement of that song that plays over and over and over. But that song, exactly, that song got stuck in my brain. And I just said, this is what I want to do. And it was just the most amazing arrangement. And even now, if you hear an old recording of it, it's an incredible arrangement.
I have it on CD.
That song made me want to get my first synthesizer. And when I finally did end up getting my first, I think it was the Radio Shack synth.
Right.
I remember just taking a little tape recorder and doing that song and working out what all the parts were. And I just thought that was like the perfect little synthesizer song. And so it was that experience of being, it wasn't just the song, it was being outside at night and hearing the song come from everywhere around. And I found out later it played off a 3M 32 track, wow. The same kind of tape machine we used with Stevie.
Wow.
And just to hear this 32 track recording coming from all over the place, including the floats as they would go by, you know, the fact that
they could,
you had this incredible synchronized thing happening. And you can imagine, it's hard to do that now. You can imagine what a nightmare that must have been.
I know. You know what?
It worked, and it was just absolutely incredible.
Because the floats would stay in sync to their own music, but each zone would be in sync to the float.
Right, and each float was playing like a different variation of the theme, but still in sync with the tree that you're standing next to.
No, it's crazy.
And I ended up meeting, I'm drawing a blank on his name, I ended up meeting the guy who wrote that song. And
really?
I did, because I did a bunch of work for Disney for the theme parks.
Wow.
Many, many decades later. But I met him, and I just told him he was one of the reasons I got into music into synthesizers in the first place.
I would have cried, Bobby, then, if I would have met that guy, because that's
pretty
awesome.
Cool.
Yeah, that's an awesome.
And you know what else? I also met the guy who wrote "It's a Small World." I think we talked about this once. And what I wanted to do was tell
him.
No, what I wanted to do was tell him how nice it was to meet him. But I wanted to tell him like 10,000 times in a row, just over and over and over. Wake him up in the middle of the night. You know, it's still really nice to meet you. It's still really nice to meet you.
Well, hey, listen, we're going to have to wrap this up. But it's been I know.
It's only been like 7 hours.
Well, we're going to talk about slates right now.
Okay.
Excellent.
My first slate was... That's been great, getting to know a little bit about each one of you and what's influenced you. And I think the main thing, one thing I want to, you know, leave people with is the fact that, you know, you pull a lot of things from, you know, back in the day or from your childhood or whatever. But there's things around you right now that can influence you and that do influence you. And man, you got to enjoy it. You got to enjoy it right now. Enjoy what you listen to. You know, some of the great movies that are coming out. You know, just get inspired, see things. There's nothing better than just appreciating somebody else's creativity. I mean, for me, that's just the biggest buzz. You know, when I'm driving and I'm listening to a new CD and it's just, it becomes a perfect musical aha moment of just like, just awesomeness. I don't know how to describe it.
You're lucky. I find it very hard at the stage of my life to actually get that.
Really?
Yep. I really do.
Bobby's a bitter man.
No. I find it very hard to put on a CD and listen to it all the way through and go.
It doesn't have to be a new one. It could be an old one.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just saying music in general, you know, and sometimes discovering older music. You maybe didn't listen to when, you know, and you're like, wow, you know.
And you know what? When you're making music, keep in mind that you might actually be inspiring somebody.
Yeah.
You know? There's somebody out there who could be listening to what you're doing
and go buy a Hot Pocket.
No. Yeah. I don't know if you'll inspire them that much.
Step on a bus.
It's a really good idea because a lot of people, especially these days, producers these days, I mean, they'll settle on an idea too quickly. They won't flesh something all the way out. I've worked with a lot of young producers who suffer from that, or they'll come up with, you know, a bridge for a song or a chorus for a song, and it's okay, but it's not great, but they just move on. Take a little extra time to make it great, because the truth is you could be inspiring someone down the road. And if you hear something later and you know it could have been better, it's going to drive you crazy.
Yeah. Take pride in what you're doing.
Yeah, take pride and think about the influence that it's going to have on other people, because anything you do, once it's out there on the net, it's going to have a life way beyond anything you can predict.
You know, that we're going to have to do another podcast on something along those lines, because about how music, the influence of music and how music is just can – it's more than just the soundtrack. It actually can dictate emotions, kind of like what Steve J was talking about way back when, a couple podcasts ago, about how it becomes part of your culture, almost part of your language. And that's what that got me thinking when you were talking about, you know, spending some time, because you don't know what you're creating and you don't know how it can influence other people. Anyhow. Well, that's enough on this one.
And I'll add one thing. You said your Juno 60.
Juno 60,
was your first synth. My first synth was a Stylophone. Look it up. I'll give you a clue. Rolf Harris.
Wow.
Give me another clue.
It's there on the web. Yeah. Right. The Stylophone.
Stylophone.
Oh, yes.
Juno 60, that was, to me, that sounded like the fattest keyboard sound in the world. Now you listen to one, and you're like, yeah.
What do you mean? I've got one. It's lovely. Nice.
You can do analog so much better now than what that did back then.
That's furry. But it's unfair.
I'm just talking about real analog. I'm not even talking about plugins. There's other keyboards I mean, everybody falls in love with the nostalgia of that machine, but let's keep it in reality where it was.
Arp Odyssey for me.
Arp's brilliant.
Arp Odyssey.
Arp was cool.
Arp's brilliant. 2600 tubes. Quite sexy.
The fattest synth I have is a Schwaemann S1, which no one's ever even heard of.
I know. I want to hear that.
C-W-E-J-M-A-N, Schwaemann.
But back very in odd. The same time around the Juno time, the Oberheims. I mean, the Oberheims were amazing.
Yeah, they were great.
And they're still amazing. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, hey, Rob, you working on anything fun and exciting that you can talk about?
I probably was, but I've probably blown the deadline because we've been sitting here talking for so long. I've actually been mixing a bunch of commercials for some Sony movies and some Lionsgate TV shows. And we've just done two massive music demos for two different commercial jobs, and I would love to be able to report when we win those jobs, but we won't know for a few more days.
Nice.
But it's been a time of doing a lot of demos and a lot of proposals and bids to try to lay out what next year is going to look like.
Cool.
Well, let's see what we have going on at work. There's actually a lot coming in. One big one that I went to try to record ocean sounds for this weekend is a pirate movie. I'm not going to say what kind. It's the fourth in a pirate movie series.
And where would say it take the place? Name.
It might take place in the ocean.
In the ocean.
Possibly a Caribbean ocean.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Not in China.
Or a Caribbean ocean.
Ah, yes.
Awesome.
Yep.
That's cool.
That and a few other things. So.
Bobby.
What am I? I'm actually doing a couple of things, but one most fun is the continuation of this sample library I'm working on. Pretty cool. It's coming up really nice, and that's what I'm pretty much primary thing I'm doing right now.
And Bobby O?
I have a full plate, actually. I'm starting as an expert witness on a huge lawsuit. It's a major record label against a even bigger media company.
Wow.
Multi-billion dollars. And unfortunately, I can't talk about the details of it. But
not yet, at least.
But it's going to take up some of my time here in the future, so it's a good thing. At an increased hourly rate, so it's all right. So there's that, and I was going to start in on a new Snoo album at the record plant next week, and we decided to push it off until January, so I'll be doing that. And, more books. Going to start on the biography with Ken Scott, one of the four Beatle engineers, pretty soon. We're going to start on that, and that should be good. It should be a lot of fun.
That's cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
And you, Mike?
Well, I did two 15-second commercials today that I won't say until they start airing what they are, but I did most of the sound design on my iPad, and it was the coolest thing ever because you could, using the touch screen, I could manipulate parameters in a very non-keyboard way and kind of play along with what I had to work with. And it was really cool. I mean, things are changing and for the better. Wow. And it's really interesting to see how you can use some of this technology.
I know you used Curtis, the granular synth. What else? Did you use anything else on that?
Yeah, I used a couple other synths and got to use the one has the XY, XY touchscreen. Yeah. It was really cool. And Curtis was awesome. Curtis, I did a ton of stuff with that.
How did you do the slates?
Good one. But that was I just thought it was kind of fun. I was going, you know what, I want to do the sound design because I wanted, you know what it was, is I needed to get some motion, and I didn't want to go to the standard swooshy sounds, right? I wanted to make it a little bit different than the swooshy. And I've been playing with this granular plugin called Curtis on the iPad, and you can record in your own sounds. So I basically what I did is I said the brand name of what I was working on, and then I could play it back backwards, right? So just because I could, I did it for no other reason. But then you can take it to the granular level and just turn some really cool different things, and you can manipulate with your fingers. You can manipulate the stereo spread by spreading your fingers, and you can also, by the panners, manipulate some of the frequencies and things like that. So you get these really organic, like I was messing with the stereo spread as I'm changing the frequency and the granularity of it. And it was really cool. It made a nice moving sound without it sounding like a swoosh, but yet not being obnoxious, you know. It was really pleasant.
I remember spending dozens of thousands of dollars for gear that could do that. And now this is
an
app on your iPad.
It's a $5 app. Seriously. And yeah. I came right out of the iPad, right into a mixer, because the output's not that good on the iPad. Boosted it up a little, fed it into Pro Tools. It sounded great. And it was really cool.
So. For $5. Yeah. Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
And we wonder why our budgets have gone down.
But you know what? Do me a favor. Don't tell anybody this, though.
Okay.
Because that's going to be
it'll be our secret.
A secret weapon. But but yeah, so I did that. And all right. Well, hey, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. You can also visit us on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/audionowcast. And that's about it, right? I think we've covered everything we need to cover.
And a bunch more.
So I'm going to go and end this so I can go slate the podcast.
Excellent. Let me know how it goes.
Everyone slates it.
All right. Well, hey, for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening. And we'll I get it.
That's the end slate.
No, that's Rob.
Is it me?
It's a Windows phone. It doesn't have an off button.
It's actually Mr. Gershon. Scott? Oh, we lost the call. I was going to put him on the podcast. Oh, well.
All right, well, we're going to
wrap this up.
We're going to end this. All right, so for myself and all the guys and Scott Gershon, who's on the other side of that phone call, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.